We begin round two. I hope my voice will hold up for the time that we have left this evening. We're going to begin this session by talking about the English Standard Version, and then we will talk about, following that, the New International Version. Someone asked me earlier in the week if I included them together because I hold them in the same light, and I'm just going to start off in case I forget to say later, no, I don't hold them in the same light. There are some things that I'm not thrilled with the English Standard Version, but in general I think they do a pretty good job. It's kind of hard to put my finger on it because I carried it with me and used it for a while, and I don't know if it was just that I was used to the New King James and the King James and I liked that better, and so I went back because it just was a little bit different. I don't tend to use it very much anymore. I don't think it's a particularly bad translation. There's some things, again, that we're going to look at. I've got a lot more concerns that we're going to look at with the New International Version than I have with any of the ones we've looked at up to this point. All right, so to start out our discussion of the English Standard Version, in their preface they state, along the lines of a purpose for the translation, "The English Standard Version, ESV, stands in the classic mainstream of English Bible translations over the past half millennium. The fountainhead of that stream was William Tyndale's New Testament of 1526, marking its course with the King James Version of 1611, the English Revised Version of 1885, the American Standard Version of 1901, and the Revised Standard Version of 1952 and 1971. In that stream, faithfulness to the text and vigorous pursuit of accuracy were combined with simplicity, beauty, and dignity of expression. Our goal has been to carry forward this legacy for a new century." All of that is basically says that they look at, you know, Tyndale's translation as being one of the early ones in this long chain of English translations, and there's some argument to be made that these are all tied together. We haven't looked at the Revised Standard or New Revised Standard. I don't know a whole lot about either one. I came across a little bit about the New Revised Standard in some of the research I did, and I didn't see lots of glowing comments about it, and that wasn't just from King James only authors. It was kind of across the board. It didn't seem like that was felt like a very good translation, but that's just, you know, from cursory readings of things, kind of tangential to what I was studying. So I don't want to make any kind of, you know, really strong statement on that because I'm just not familiar enough with those versions to make that comment. But the argument can be made that from Tyndale came the King James, and from the King James came the English Revised Version, from which came the American Standard Version, from which came the Revised Standard and the New Revised Standard, and they're tying this into that chain. One of the interesting things that I think you'll see about the English Standard, if you use it very much, is the phrasing feels more King James, New King James, than what you would see out of the American Standard or New American Standard. The word orders seem to follow more closely what you might see in the New King James. The sentence structures have that kind of feel to them as opposed to what you see in the New American Standard. And that's one of the reasons that I kind of did like it, was because it makes use of some of the newer text, the Greek text, in doing the translating as the New American Standard did, but it kind of maintained the overall sentence type structures that the New King James did. And so it just was more comfortable for me because it was closer to what I was used to reading than something like the New American Standard. The translation was completed in 2001, and it was revised in 2007. This is such a new translation. Finding some of the more detailed information about it that we did with things like the New American Standard and the American Standard, the King James, was a little harder to do. When there's 300 plus years of history, it's kind of easy to find a whole bunch of stuff. And when there's 3 to 10 years of history, there's just not as much out there about it. So it was just a little harder to find some information about this particular translation. A lot of the resources, the primary resources I was using were all written before this translation was done, and so that made it kind of difficult to find some things as well. But from, again, the preface, one of the great things that I will say is all of the more modern translations have lots of good information about the translation in their prefaces. The King James did that. The New King James had some good stuff. The American Standard, not so much. They had a lot about kind of how they approached some of the translating ideas, but they didn't have so much about what their general approach, what the style of translation was, who the translators were, those types of things. Just, it didn't have nearly that same kind of information as what we see in a lot of these newer translations. For better or worse, at least they're providing their perspective of the work that they've done. And so, again, in the preface of the ESV, we can read, the ESV is essentially literal, is an essentially literal translation that seeks as far as possible to capture the precise wording of the original text and the personal style of each Bible writer. As such, its emphasis is on word-for-word correspondence, at the same time taking into account differences of grammar, syntax, and idiom between current literary English and the original languages. Thus, it seeks to be transparent to the original text, letting the reader see as directly as possible the structure and meaning of the original. Of all of the translations that we've looked at so far, this one probably makes the strongest statement that they're trying to do a literal word-for-word translation. And so, that at least in their words, that's what they're trying to do with this translation. They also are very explicit in defining what text they use. The ESV is based on the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible, as found in Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia. I think that's because the guy who did this was German, so Justin might know what that word means better than he says no, so he doesn't know what it is either. It's when I said it, it sounds German, so I don't know. Anyway, it was the second the second edition. That is a subsequent volume to what we saw from the New American Standard that used also the Biblica Hebraica. It just used a much earlier version than this one did because the translating was done a number of years before. And on the Greek text, in the 1993 edition of the Greek New Testament, Fourth Corrected Edition, published by the United Bible Societies, and Novum Testatum Graecae, edited by Nestle Allen. And so the Greek text they use is the Nestle Allen United Bible Society text, and that's the one that we were talking about a little bit earlier. It's what is considered to be the eclectic text, the one where they try to look at as many manuscripts as they can and make an educated decision about which ones are the correct readings, as opposed to having a blanket rule that says just because it's the oldest, it must be the best, or just because it's in the most manuscripts, it must be the right one. And so they try to look at more evidence beyond just those things in determining what the correct text to use would be. They also say, in exceptional difficult cases, other sources were consulted to shed possible light on the text, or if necessary, to support a divergence from the Masoretic text. Simply, in a few difficult cases in the New Testament, the ESV has followed a Greek text different from the text given in the UBS Nestle Allen 27th edition. And so, if they felt like that the NU was not what it should be, then they used other texts to try to cover that. All right, the translators were made up of a 12-member translation oversight committee, and there were more than 50 translation review scholars and a 50-member advisory council. So around 112 men involved in doing the translating. Again, from the preface of the ESV, the ESV has its own website that's run by the publishers of the Bible, of that translation, ESV.org. I found a lot of really good information there about their translation as well. So they say and I can't remember which one came from which, but the quotation that I have, it is a quote from one or the other. The translation review scholars are an international team from many denominations chosen to review the books of the Old or New Testament in conjunction with the Translation Oversight Committee based on their special expertise in the original languages and specific books of the Bible. All they're really saying there is, under the oversight of a committee, they chose men to do the New Testament who were Greek scholars, and they chose men to do the Old Testament who were Hebrew scholars. This 100-member team, which shares a common commitment to the truth of God's Word and to historic Christian orthodoxy, is international in scope and includes leaders in many denominations. And again, you know, we talked before about the idea that the broader the background of the men involved in the translating, the harder it is for any particular bias to make its way into the translation. And so that's why it's often good to see a wide variety of background in the men doing the translating. As we've talked with some of the other translations, some of the general points of interest, the ESV does use footnotes to identify the location of Old Testament quotes. The poetry is rendered in contemporary verse format. Inserted words are not indicated. You will not see italics indicating words that the translators inserted for clarification. I don't like that. This is one of the things that makes me a little uncomfortable with this, because you can't tell while you're reading when the translators inserted words in an effort to clarify what the passage is saying. We looked a couple of nights ago at the passage in John when Jesus is being arrested and he says, "Who are you looking for?" And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am." And in all the translations that we've talked about to this point, the "he" in that verse is in italics, indicating it was inserted by the translators because they thought it would make it clearer. And if you read it without, you can see a deeper meaning than you see with the "he" in there. In the ESV, that is not indicated. It's "he" is in the text as if it were in the Greek text. I don't think that's a good way to approach things, and that is one of the things that makes me a little more uncomfortable with this than with some of the others we've looked at. In our questionable passages that we've looked at, Mark 16:9 through 20 has this line in between verse 8 and verse 9. It says, "Some of the earliest manuscripts do not include 16:9 through 20. And so it's giving you right into the text the indication that the next set of verses is questioned whether it belongs or not. In Acts 8 and verse 37, that verse is in the footnotes only. It is not in the text in any way. Most of the translations that do this just skip 37 in the numbering. And so they recognize that there are some who feel that the 37 should be there. They don't, so they don't put it in the text. But they leave 37, that number open, and you'll see when you're reading it that it will go straight from 36 to 38. And 37 just will not be there. It's in the footnotes. And I forgot to mention, Mark 16:9-20, in addition to having this line inserted, it is also separated from the rest of the chapter by extra spacing, and it has a very extensive footnote explaining why maybe it shouldn't be included in the text. Probably the most extensive explanation in any of the translations that I've seen. The English Standard does do a good job with one of the verses we've looked at before, Psalms 51:5. Excuse me. "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and sin did my mother conceive me." Again, putting the sin on the mother, not on the child. This is probably the last translation we'll look at that handles this verse well. All the other ones, I think, we're going to see that it doesn't do so well with. We looked at 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 in the last session, talking about how the New American Standard renders it. The ESV does a better job. It's more along the lines of what we see in the King James, New King James American Standard rendering it. "Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered, as opposed to the 'as with someone weaker since she is a woman' terminology that we saw in the NASB. We talked about a couple of nights ago how some of the different translations handle John 3:16. "For God so loved the world that He gave His only Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have eternal life." The King James, the New King James, and I didn't think to check, I would think the American Standard and probably the New American Standard use "only begotten Son of God." And we talked a little bit about why that was important, and I'm not sure it was very clear because Dad was asking me questions about that afterwards. I have not been able to find in Scripture anywhere where Christ is referred to as the Son before He was born to Mary in Matthew. He was God. He's referred to in John as the Word. He's referred to, John tells us He created. You know, there's lots of things that were told about Him that indicate His deity, but there's no, that I have been able to find at least, no reference to Him as the Son until He was born the Son of God. The Scriptures tell us that Mary was found with child of the Holy Spirit, that He was the Son of God in a way that no one else in the history of the world was the Son of God, because He was born physically of God. That's why I think only begotten Son is so important in this verse, because there is a very real sense in which we are all sons of God, children of God. But we are adopted by God. We are not born His Son the way Christ was born His Son. And I think that's why only begotten is so important in this verse, because I think it not only detracts from who Christ was by not having it in there, but I think it changes our perspective on our relationship with God by not being there. I think it affects both of those. And so I hope that's a little clearer maybe than the way that I said that a couple of nights ago. And so I'm not comfortable with not having only begotten in there. It's a term that should be in the verse. Another interesting passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 25. Now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. The word translated betrothed there is also translated that way in verses 34, 36, 37, and 38. But in most translations, it's translated as virgin. It's the same word that we see translated as virgin in most places. And we see below in the King James, concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment. Most of the more literal translations will use virgin, and that should be the correct rendering of the Greek word there. Betrothed just does not handle that. It doesn't mean the same thing, and it doesn't give the same implication as virgin does. Another interesting one in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I'm going to read verses 3 through 5. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. Now, the point tonight is not to discuss whether women should wear a covering and whether men should not. The point is to discuss why these verses use the broad man, but the much more narrow wife in discussing these issues. And what we can readily see in doing, you know, some very cursory research is that the Greek word can be translated either way. The Greek word that's translated man here can be man or husband. The one that's translated wife can be woman or wife. The context is what determines how that word is translated. There's nothing in this context that would demand that man would be subject to Christ, but that it would narrow it to only married women are subject and only to their husbands, and doing that in the translating, so that you're saying that... I looked at you and you threw me off. You got that? My dad gets this look on his face when he's thinking, and it makes me think like I really messed something up. But the point is, the consistency would demand that these verses would translate the Greek word man and woman, not man and wife. If you're going to use wife, you almost have to use husband to go with it. You can't use one in this context without the other. And obviously, no one would say only married men are subject to Christ. Single men can do whatever they want. And so that forces us to conclude that all men are subject to Christ, And in the authority hierarchy, then women are subject to men, not wives to their husbands. And so this is very poorly handled in how they do the translating of these verses. I hope that's clearer than I felt like I made it. Now, I realize that most of what we said about the ESV was negative. In all the translations we looked at so far, this would be the one I would be least likely to use. We're going to look at some more that I would be much less likely to use than even this one. The ESV does do a good job in a lot of places. I've keyed on some of the more negative ones. And as I'm going through, I was trying to get so many different things ready that I just realized I'm going through this, that I was almost completely negative about it. I don't feel as negative about it as you might think after seeing what I've presented, but it definitely has more areas of concern, I think, than what we've seen in some of the previous ones, and how it handles some things. It's not consistent in some ways that it should be, and it definitely translates some things in ways that it shouldn't, that give it much less of a literal feel than what we've seen in some of the previous translations. They claim that it's a literal translation, and in a lot of ways it is, but there are definitely some places where they're a little freer with their inserting something other than the literal for the sake of clarity than I think maybe we would be happy with in most cases. I wouldn't feel backward about using the ESV, especially as a second reference. You know, I would probably use one of the four we've talked about so far as a primary Bible. I wouldn't feel bad at all about using this as a second look. I don't see how it does it as opposed to what I've been looking at already. We're going to move on then and talk about the New International Version. Just so there's no confusion, I don't like this translation. There's a couple things that it does really well, but there are some things that it does really bad. And it handles, there's one particular thing we're going to look at that to me kind of puts it over the top of, I wouldn't use it as a primary source for study. It might be a useful fourth, fifth type of thing to look at. If I've looked at three or four others and I'm still having some issues maybe trying to figure it out, then it's definitely going to use some clearer language, but that means that it's not as technically accurate as what we've seen in some of the other translations. The NIV states in its preface that the purpose was that it would be an accurate translation and one that would have clarity and literary quality and so prove suitable for public and private reading, teaching, preaching, memorizing, and liturgical use. So they basically want this to be for everybody. They want it to be for you to read in your home and for preachers and priests and, you know, clerics and clergy and anybody that, you know, they're trying to hit the broad spectrum. But the intent really is to make it readable. And in their efforts to make it more readable, they're going to detract from the accuracy. And that, you know, we talked a couple of nights ago about the difference between a formal equivalence and a dynamic equivalence. This is the first one that we're going to see, even they claim is a dynamic equivalent. It's their primary approach is not formal equivalence. Their primary approach is dynamic equivalence, and this is the first one we've looked at that's the case. Just a couple of date things to go along with this one. Discussions about beginning this translation started in a meeting that was held in Palos Heights, Illinois, in 1965. In 1973, the New Testament was published. 1978, the entire Bible was published, including some revisions to the New Testament. And then in 1983, there were some further revisions. And as far as I know, that was the last revision. Again, a lot of the primary sources I was using were from about 95. And so there might have been some more recent things that I just wasn't able to find. This next quote is one that is what begins giving me cause for concern with the NIV. The first concern of the translators has been the accuracy of the translation and its fidelity to the thought of the biblical writers. They have weighed the significance of the lexical and grammatical details of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek texts. At the same time, they have striven for more than a word-for-word translation. Now, here's a couple of questions. How do they know what the thoughts of the writers were beyond what they wrote? The Bible tells us that no one knows the mind of a man unless that man reveals it to you. And if the writers didn't reveal it, then you can't know what they were thinking. You can only know what they said. And to say that they are striving for more than a word-for-word translation just smacks of adding to the Scriptures. That they're making changes, and they can't be based on the text because they tell you flat out that they're going to do more than a word-for-word translation. And that they're concerned with the thoughts of the biblical writers more than the words of the biblical writers. And so the fact that in the preface they tell you that is cause for concern. Now, I know brethren who use the NIV, and you can't convince them that this is true, and you can read it to them right out of the preface of the Bible they're carrying, and they don't believe that it's true. But when they, you know, there are instances in the other translations that we've looked at where they said they were doing word for word, and we can find evidence that they didn't. And we understand in some cases that's even necessary. But when they flat out tell you up front, we're going to do a dynamic equivalent, we're going to try to tell you what they were thinking, not what they said, you're just asking for trouble. And you're definitely asking for a translation that's not going to be as accurate as one where the translators are striving to give you word for word as closely as possible what was written in the text. As far as the textual basis that they used, for the Old Testament, the standard Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, was published as published in the latest editions of Biblia Hebraica, was used throughout. The Dead Sea Scrolls contain material bearing on an earlier stage of Hebrew text. They were consulted, as were the Samaritan Pentateuch and the ancient scribal traditions relating to textual changes. And they kind of go through some other kind of related things there. Then it goes on and says, the translators also consulted the more important early versions, the Septuagint, Aquila, Symmachus, Theodotion. Your guess is as good as mine on pronunciation on that one. The Vulgate, the Syriac, Peshitta, the Targums, and for the Psalms, the Juxta Hebraica of Jerome. Readings from these versions were occasionally followed where Masoretic text seemed doubtful and where accepted principles of textual criticism showed that one or more of these textual witnesses appeared to provide the correct reading. Such instances are footnoted. Basically, all that's saying is, for the most part, they use the same Hebrew text as what we've talked about in all the other translations. A Hebrew text is based on the Masoretic manuscripts. But in some cases, they chose to go with some other textual readings, and in those cases they noted them with footnotes so that you would know where they departed from the Masoretic text. On the New Testament side, they say the Greek text used in translating the New Testament was an eclectic one. No other piece of ancient literature has such an abundance of manuscript witnesses as does the New Testament. Where existing manuscripts differ, the translators made their choice of readings according to the accepted principles of New Testament's textual criticism. Footnotes call attention to places where there was uncertainty about what the original text was. The best current printed texts of the Greek New Testament were used. They don't come out and say it in so many words, but they're using the Nestle Aland United Bible Society text. That's the one that they used in doing this translation. They go on and say, in regard to who did the translating, the New International Version is a completely new translation of the Holy Bible made by over 100 scholars working directly from the best available Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek texts. This group, though not made up of official church representatives, was transdenominational. Its conclusion was endorsed by a large number of leaders from many denominations who met in Chicago in 1966. Generally, when we see a broad spectrum of backgrounds represented in doing the translating, it's harder for bias to enter in. Unfortunately, for the NIV, that's not really true. There are some places where bias enters in some pretty strong evidence. They go on and say, but another theological stance to be considered is that in the wildest sense of the word, all of the translators were evangelicals, and the majority of the translators were adherents to the doctrines of Calvinism. This quote was taken not from the New International Version itself. This was taken from an article written by Farrell Jenkins called The New International Version's Translation of Sarex, which we're going to look at that word in a minute. So Brother Jenkins says, but another theological stance to be considered is that in the wildest sense of the word, all of the translators were evangelicals, and that the majority of the translators were adherents to the doctrines of Calvinism. Edwin H. Palmer, author of the Five Points of Calvinism, was the executive secretary of the NIV's Committee on Bible Translation during its production. So you've got a Calvinist running the show and a number of Calvinists in proportion to other representatives much higher on the committee doing the translating. Now, the final quote on here comes from a book by Carolyn Youngblood called The New International Version Translation Project, and she claims that all of the translators were required to subscribe to this concept: the Bible alone and the Bible in its entirety is the Word of God written and is therefore inerrant in the autographs. They have supposedly agreed to that, but when we see how they handle some things in the translating, it's not so apparent that they really believe that. And we're going to see again that there's some very strong evidence that their Calvinistic concepts were, you know, inserted into some of the translating that they did. Again, some of the general things that we talked about with other ones. Footnotes do identify the location of Old Testament quotes. Poetry is rendered in contemporary verse format. Inserted words, again, are not indicated. So once again, you do not see italicized words to indicate ones that were inserted by translators in an effort to be more clear. And how they handle the couple of questionable passages we've already been talking about, Mark 16, 9 through 20, you see it is separated from the rest of the chapter by a dividing line and extra spacing, and this wording, the most reliable early manuscripts and other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16, 9 through 20. And in Acts 8, verse 37, it is in the footnotes only. Now, that's not entirely inconsistent with what we've seen with some of the other translations. Now, before we get into what I don't like, there's a couple that I do want to hit that I do like. We talked about one already a couple of nights ago. In Revelation 2 and verse 10, we read, "Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life." I think that captures what is being said in this verse well. It inserts some words in there to emphasize that meaning more than you see in any other translation. The King James, the American Standard, and the English Standard all say unto death, but not even to the point of death. It's a wordier way of saying, I think, essentially the same thing, and it to me seems a little clearer, and so I'm not entirely unhappy with that, because I think it is making the point that is being made there. As opposed to, as we talked about, the until translation, which doesn't seem to have the same urgency to it that the unto does, in the light of the fact that part of what John is telling them in writing this is, you're going, or as he's quoting, as John is writing this down, is quoting this, is that they're going to suffer persecution that is going to lead to the death of some of them. Be faithful even to the point that you die for your faith. And that's the point that is being made in this passage. And so I like the way that that is worded there. Another one, again, we talked about this one in other translations earlier, Acts 2 and verse 40. The NIV says, "With many other words he warned them, and he pleaded with them, 'Save yourselves from this corrupt generation.'" There's a great irony in them getting this verse so well in light of what we're going to see with some of the other things where they're inserting the Calvinism into the translating, because if you wanted a verse to have a more passive, it's not my responsibility, it's God's approach to it. This is the verse, and other versions do, in fact, like the New King James, where it says, be saved from this perverse generation. We talked about that last night, the idea of an active versus a passive voice. In the NIV, there's an action required. Save yourselves. You have to act. But in the New King James, it can leave the impression that you're waiting for someone to save you, that you don't have anything to do yourself. And so it just kind of amazes me that the NIV did this one so well in light of what we're going to see in some other places. Like some of the other newer translations, it's inconsistent in the way that it handles the word porneia. In Matthew 19 and verse 9, it reads, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. That just is, seems like it has that feel of a little more broad term than fornication. I don't think it's really any worse than sexual immorality. I think it probably is in the ballpark in how it would be generally perceived. But either way, it's not as strong as fornication. It's not as clear as using that word. In Acts 15 and verse 20, the same word, porneia, is translated, instead we should write to them, telling them to abstain from food polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, and from meat of strangled animals, and from blood. And the marital unfaithfulness, by the way, is also used in Matthew 5:32. The sexual immorality is also used in Acts 15:29, 1 Corinthians 6:18, Jude 7. And those are just a few of the examples that I had of other places where those were used. So again, you have two different ways of translating the word porneia, neither one of which is as accurate as it should be. And so, again, something just to be aware of with this one. And now we start the downhill slide. Psalm 51 and verse 5 in the NIV says, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. I'll just reiterate. If you're wanting to look at a translation and determine if it's going to have a Calvinistic bent to it or not, this is the verse to go to. Because everyone that I've looked at, and I haven't looked at them all, obviously, because we saw on Wednesday night that we had a list of 130 translations, and that was probably just the tip of the iceberg. So I obviously haven't looked at them all. But all the ones that I have looked at, If it translates this verse as the NIV does, you're going to see other Calvinistic concepts worked into the translating in other places. And usually, if you see this translated as it is in the New King James, as we saw in the King James, the American Standard, the New American Standard, the English Standard, they're not going to have that overt Calvinistic bent to the way they do the translating. And that's just it's not one of those that's true in every case, but it's a good rule of thumb. And so a lot of times when I'm interested to see how well a Bible is translated, this is now the first verse I go to. Because you're going to get this idea very quickly from looking at this verse. All right, so the last thing that we have to look at is the way that the NIV handles the Greek word sarx. The way that, for instance, it is translated in Romans chapter 8 and verse 3 is, for what the law was powerless to do in that it was weakened by the sinful nature, God did by sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful man to be a sin offering. The term there, sinful nature, is the Greek word sarx. It is generally translated in other translations simply as flesh. And the Greek definition indicates that it's talking about the body. Even in relation to animals, it's talking about the flesh that you eat. It's talking about the physical body. But the NIV translates that in a way that indicates that man has a nature that is sinful from birth. It's the sinful nature of man. And that is one of the basic tenets of Calvinism, that we are born in sin, just as we saw in Psalm 51 and verse 5. And so it translates this, and it does it very consistently, translating sarx as sinful nature. Now, it doesn't do it every time. We're going to see an instance in a minute, and it's really interesting how they do it. But what we would see in a more literal translation is, for what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God did by sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh on account of sin. He condemned sin in the flesh. You see here that it's simply translated flesh. The idea, at least as I'm reading it, is the law couldn't do what it was done because it was a physical law. It was the law of the flesh. And so it couldn't do what was needed, and so God sent Christ so that He could do what was needed. The interesting thing in the NIV, and it's true in as we see here in the New King James, the word, the phrase that's translated sinful flesh the second time in these verses is sarx. It's the same word. The interesting thing is, why does the NIV translate it as sinful nature in the first and sinful man in the second? And the reason is because if they translated it sinful nature in the second, it would indicate that Christ was sinful when He was born. So they translate it in such a way to show that man is sinful from when he's born, but Christ wasn't sinful when He was born. And if that doesn't fly of Calvinism, then I'm not sure what would. Except in you know, a few instances like this, when it's generally translated, it's translated sinful nature. This is the other point that makes me very uncomfortable with the New International Version. The first one, again, was that they tell you up front that they're going to try to give you the thoughts of the writers. The second one is that there is this obvious, overt attempt to write Calvinism into the way they translate it. When you don't see these verses translated that way in any other translations that are known for their literalness, even translations that use the same Greek text, and the New American Standard uses an older version but is a somewhat similar Greek textual basis to what the ESV used. The ESV is using essentially the same Greek text as the NIV, just a newer version of it. They don't translate it this way. So the translators are inserting these concepts into the translation on their own because they're not in the text no matter what Greek text you're looking at. And to just say, well, it's a difference in the Greek text, sometimes that's a legitimate point. In this case, it's not. It's the same word that's used no matter what the Greek text is. It's just they translate it in a way that suits the doctrine that they're trying to push. One final quote on that point. Oh, I forgot. I had that fancy circle to go up there and circle sinful man. I forgot to do it. One final quote on this. This, again, is from the article by Farrell Jenkins. He says, "It is granted that sarx does not have the same meaning in every occurrence, and many of the renderings of the NIV are quite good. The problem is that the NIV has used sinful nature only when it seems to bolster the theological view of hereditary total depravity. The use of so many different words and phrases by which to render sarx obliterates the actual usage of sarx." And part of what he's saying there is, by translating it in different ways to suit their purposes, it's hard to distinguish from the English that it's the same term in the Greek. You lose that ability to know it's the same idea because they intentionally hide it in the way that they translate it into English. And so this is the first of the versions we've talked about that I would be very negative about using as a primary study Bible. Now, I mentioned last night, there are those who would say if you're not using the King James or if you're not using a particular translation or from a set of translations, then you'll go to hell. You have to use one of these ones or you'll go to hell. I think we have to be careful about that. Some of the reading that I did, you know, some good points were made about the fact that some people may have not done enough research to know why that's not a good translation. Some people may be new Christians that just haven't had an opportunity to learn that there are translations that would serve them better. And many of them may move to better translations as they learn those things. But if we club people over the head over the translation they're using, we're not going to make any progress in teaching them the truth. I would feel pretty confident that you could even take a New International Version and you could teach somebody that they need to understand and believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that they need to repent of their sins, that they need to confess Christ as Lord, and they need to be baptized for the remission of their sins. I believe I could do that even from the New International Version. And if they can learn how to be saved from it, then we certainly don't need to be beating them over the head over it. Now, there are some translations that I would be, even pretty quickly with some folks, pretty adamant they need to move away from. I would try to convince people they should move to a better translation than the New International Version, but I wouldn't just beat them up over it. And I've talked to people about it. I know people who use it. I've talked to them about it. I've opened it up to the preface and showed them what the translator said about their intent in doing the translation. And that's all that you can do. There would be situations where I would ask people not to use that in certain ways. You know, if I'm preaching a sermon and somebody asks me about the scripture reading, I'm going to try to make sure they're not going to read it out of the New International Version unless I'm sure that that's going to be a good rendering of the passage that I'm going to use. Sometimes I have a particular translation that I want and you know, because it reads in a certain way that helps make some of the points I want to make, and I think that's fine. But again, I just want us to be cautious in how we approach that. I think everyone here is interested in learning about these things so they can know what the good and the bad translations are, so they can avoid the ones that aren't as good as the others. And I would say this is one that's not as good as the others. This one doesn't meet the standard of any of the translations that we've talked about up to this point. It's as good as some of the ones we're going to... Well, it's probably as good as the next one we're going to look at tomorrow morning. The last one we're going to look at is probably the worst one of them all. I have a feeling you're going to find that is going to be true. So that is all that I have on that tonight. I hope, again, that you found that to be useful information. And again, if you've got some questions about some of this, I'll be glad to answer them as well as I can. I've done a lot of research for this meeting, but I'm by no means an expert, and so please be willing to accept a I don't know the answer to that question answer if I don't know the answer to that question. I would rather tell you I don't know than give you an answer that's not true. And so the other thing I can tell you is most of the material that I used in preparing this is readily available. You just have to be careful of what you're looking at. There's a lot of information available online about all these translations. Just make sure when you're reading things that you're on reputable sites that are managed by people who would have a balanced approach to things rather than an axe to grind in such a way that they're not going to be fair with the material. One of the quotes that I saw on one of the websites said something to the effect of, we need to be doing research with material that is not overly influenced by emotion. And all too often, when you're looking at things like King James only sites, you're going to see highly emotional arguments, things that if you sit down and look at the evidence, you'll see very quickly are not always true, sometimes very much not true. And they're just thrown out there and they're very emotional about how they do it. And so you just need to be careful about that. But there's lots of material out there. So if I'm not able to answer the question for you tonight, go do some digging. You can find a lot of good information available on a lot of different places. Of all the translations, the only one that I'm aware of that maintains its own site is the ESV. And that one was ESV.org. And it had some interesting information about the translating and some things about that translation that I found real useful. And it's produced by the people who produced the Bible, that translation. And so if anybody's going to be somewhat fair with their material, it's going to be the people who are producing that. They're going to try to sell it to you, but so be it. Thanks again for your attention, and I'm glad that you all were able to be here tonight. I hope that you are too, and I'm going to sit down now, and Justin's going to lead us another song.